The following audio is included in the Worldwide Church of God Library Collection. Please visit wwcg-library.com and explore the incredible truths that answer the mysteries of life.
Personal insight concerning the state of California's recent actions.
From the outset in this conflict between the state, California, the largest, most powerful state in the Union, and the Worldwide Church of God, Mr. Helge and I have been as frustrated as two people could possibly be, because from the outset, we have had to use other lawyers in every form except the times that we were appearing before the media as our mouthpieces. We've been able to help them draft the pleadings. We've been able to help them to prepare the oral arguments. We've been able to plan the strategy, develop the tactics. But the two people in the church who know the most about church in terms of the law, in terms of the relationship of the church to the sovereign state of California, to the federal government for that matter, have literally been hamstrung and hogtied by the sham lawsuit that was filed by the state of California and the so-called six relators 7 months ago. But for Mr. Helge and me being named as defendants, we would have been able to defend the church as we always have. And we have had other lawsuits at other times just as irresponsible as this one. I can go to my files and show you case after case over the years where wild allegations have been made, and each and every case, Mr. Helge and I have managed to literally destroy the opposition by pointing out to the courts, whether it be a federal court or state court, sometimes as far away as Alaska, that the complaint was a sham. But in this particular case, Mr. Helge and I, being named as defendants, have had to try to coach our lawyers, to coordinate the team, to speed up the vertical learning curve of all of our lawyers. And as I told Mr. Armstrong, I said, I really think it's impossible to get them to feel about the case, to react as we would, short of converting them. And I don't think we're going to be able to convert them all that easily. It's not that they're not working hard at it. It's not that they're not learning. But there's something about this lawsuit that makes Mr. Helge and me, as well as Mr. Armstrong and any other member of the church, rise up in indignation. Not because we were sued, because unfortunately in this world, anyone can sue anybody. We know that. People are grieved over non-existing injuries all the time, and they sue A, B, or C, and sometimes they are thrown out of court immediately. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer. But in this particular case, to see Mr. Armstrong, the leader of the church, 47 years, accused of siphoning and pilfering millions of dollars each year for his own benefit, to hear the state accuse him of using the church and church assets for his own personal benefit, to hear them describe his spreading of the gospel, his fulfilling of the commissions laid out in Matthew 24:14 as so-called travel expense, makes Mr. Helge and I want to rise up out of our chairs and literally throttle the person responsible for making such a wild allegation. But that's what you're confronted with when you have a sham complaint. Now, ordinarily, with the amount of evidence that we have adduced, that we have offered, when the burden of proof, by the way, is not even on us, the burden of proof's on the state, nonetheless, we have come forward with an overwhelming amount of evidence. The state's come up with no evidence of any wrongdoing, but we've come up with a mountain of evidence indicating clearly for any disinterested person that all the allegations of the complaint are false and without foundation. Notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding a finding by Judge Title as early as the 6th or 7th of January that there was no evidence of any of the allegations in the complaint has not been dismissed. Now, the reason for that's quite plain. The court itself is a little intimidated by the fact that the state of California is involved. And they, as the judiciary, are part of the system. Mr. Armstrong has always said, government is the enemy of the church. Government, to a great extent, is the enemy of the people. There is no justice in this world. We've all learned those things, and it's coming home now. Every day, we're being reminded of that. Now, when I talk about a sham complaint, what do I mean? I mean a complaint that is based upon hearsay and gossip. And a complaint that is contrived under such circumstances as to be apparent to any person that the plaintiff, in this case the state, had no reason to believe that it would ever be able to prove the allegations of the complaint. Now, when you analyze that, you might say, well, if that be the case, how do they expect to prove up the lawsuit? Well, any shrewd observer would realize immediately that the state of California never asked itself whether what they were doing is right or wrong, whether what they were doing was legal or illegal, whether what they were doing was ethical or unethical. They only asked themselves, can we get away with it? It was the raw use of power. Can we get away with it? Now, when they asked themselves that question, and we can later on discuss why they wanted to get away with it to begin with, when they asked themselves, can we get away with it, what factors did they consider? They considered the information that had been brought to them. They were told that this church was relatively small, which was good. They were told that it was divided, that there was a lot of dissension in the ranks. They were told that its spiritual leader and modern founder, you might say, was a much disliked person, an autocrat, living in Arizona, cut off from the brethren, cut off from the employees, cut off from the ministry, and that if someone made a move on him like the state of California, why, he would just fold up and go away. He was described as senile by a person whom he treated as for all practical purposes, a son. He was called drug-ridden, confined to bed, unable to hear, unable to see. You name it, they mentioned it. They were told that there were other people who were just as equally disliked. And I became a target. They were told that all the people were waiting for was the power of the state to move on the church, throw out Mr. Armstrong, throw out the other people, the palace guard, and they believed it. They want to believe it. Consequently, a little bit of the Bay of Pigs philosophy was perhaps what we're talking about. All of you remember how the CIA was convinced that with a handful of people, they would be able to invade Cuba. Didn't work out very well. Same thing occurred here. These people landed on our shores, and within a few weeks, they were routed. Now we have a lawsuit, and the state gives everyone reason to believe that they're never going to be able to prove the allegations of their complaint. They have hundreds and thousands, maybe 60,000 documents now belonging to the state, or 60,000 pieces of paper, and they still can't find any evidence of any wrongdoing. And Judge Julius Title himself said there was no evidence of any wrongdoing, and as late as March indicated that all the state had been doing is making accusations. And we have the very best lawyers, but we like them all very much. And there's so much better than what the state can muster that it isn't even a ball game, you know what I mean? It's like child's play. But Mr. Helge and I not only have such a firm handle on the law, but a firm handle on the facts, that in dealing with our own lawyers, it's like we're light years ahead of them. We know what we know about the law, and we know what we know about the facts, because we have been dealing with the law and the facts here for a period of 40 years between the two of us, in a highly specialized set of circumstances. On top of that, we are members of the church. Now, I was always a very good advocate for the church, even before 1975, when I became a member. I was always able, as a good advocate, to get a lot of the necessary emotion into my pleadings, whatever they might be, whatever I was arguing for, or pleading for, or advocating. Because of the tremendous love and admiration and respect that I had not only for Mr. Armstrong, but for the church brethren that I'd met over the years, and for the colleagues to a certain extent that I'd worked with closely here, and just the, you might say, the rank and file of the employees I'd come in contact with. But then, 75, when I became a member, which I didn't have to do, there's no reason on earth why I should become a member unless I had that particular calling that we all who are members know something about. I mean, I was earning more money before. I didn't have political problems before. I didn't have quite, maybe some people were saying, we wonder why Mr. Armstrong spends so much time with an unconverted man, but that was his problem, wasn't it? It wasn't mine. And then I became a member, and all of a sudden people began to even be more concerned about me and my presence. But once I became a member, now I was not only fighting for a cause of a client, but I was fighting for something that I believed in very strongly myself. So Mr. Helge and I were constantly inciting, urging, coercing, trying to bring our lawyers up to that same level of knowledge as to the law and the facts, and to also try to get into their systems some of what we have, which becomes a natural indignation. I mean, it becomes something you're highly offended by, and this type of thing that you really want to get physical about it. And Mr. Helge's a former Marine, you know, and he's 17, and he was over in China. And I think he's had difficulty restraining himself physically from time to time. And when I get to talking about it on other occasions, I find myself a little bit bemused because I am not as emotionally surcharged as I am most of the time talking to our own lawyers. Talking to the press, it is varied. If the press has been accusatory in tone and has missed by a mile what I thought the facts were, I thought it was important to put the press in its place because I thought they were very short-sighted in not realizing that the First Amendment begins with freedom of religion, not freedom of press. And as I told them in the corridors the very first week in January when this whole thing broke, they cry like stuffed pigs when their own First Amendment rights are concerned. And sure enough, the last 4 or 5 months, the Supreme Court has been kicking them around daily. And they have literally been crying on the front pages of the newspapers, on the television networks, and on the editorial pages as well. But there is that aspect of it, that it's hard to get people today, even our own lawyers, excited about the First Amendment. And I've told people that, I've told the newspaper people that, I've told the media that, that when this country was founded 200 years ago, people were very concerned about the First Amendment because so much bloodshed had taken place over matters of religion, so much persecution had taken place over the matters of religion. Wars almost invariably had been fought over matters of religion. And these people established this country 200 years ago were determined to have no state interference with anyone's religious belief. They were determined to have no state establishment, as was the case in England. And God and religion were very important to these people. Maybe not each person to the same degree, but certainly no one would have thought of publishing a Time magazine in 1790 stating, "Is God dead?" That would have never occurred to anybody. They were quite sure God was alive and that they were quite accountable to Him. Today, we live in a different society, and although we're very much concerned about the abridgment of our religious freedoms, not everybody is all that excited about it. So there is that problem that we're forced to contend with constantly. Then we have an anomaly. Our most successful ad, the ad that we designed to bring to the public certain facts about the lawsuit, was the one that stated we have nothing to hide but much to protect. By that I meant, and Mr. Armstrong meant, we literally have nothing to hide, because that's never been our approach to begin with before the lawsuit. We have been a very open institution, much more open than the law requires us to be, much more open than most churches are. Mr. Armstrong, in a way, is like the lover who wears his heart on his sleeve. He's always telling people just about everything that comes to his mind. And he himself has said, well, he'd rather err on the side of being too, willing to reveal things about himself and about the institution than to be secretive. And as a consequence, for us now to be in a position of protecting our First Amendment rights and everybody's First Amendment rights, while the state accuses us of hiding something, creates somewhat of an anomaly. Now, if the state hadn't attacked the church, then the issues would have been different. Mr. Armstrong and I have said from the very outset, you have no business addressing ourselves to the state. You have no business attacking the church. You have no right to be here. Get your feet off our property. Get your dirty hands off of our property. If you have something to complain about concerning Mr. Armstrong or Mr. Rader or Mr. Helge or anybody for that matter, there's a proper form for that type of matter. And although no one likes to be accused of activity that even sounds like criminal activity, we'd be still very happy to defend ourselves in that form at the right time and the right place. And we would not have been able to raise the First Amendment. And we never would have thought of raising the First Amendment. Maybe Mr. Armstrong would be required from time to time to raise a clergyman penitent privilege. Maybe on occasion Mr. Helge would have to raise the question of attorney-client privilege. Maybe on occasion I would have had to do the same. But we certainly could not have raised the First Amendment. But the moment that the state of California intruded upon state affairs, we had a duty, an absolute duty, to raise the First Amendment. Not only a duty to ourselves, but to all other people for whom the freedom of religion is important. I told Mr. Armstrong, and he remembers this very, very clearly, the very first day I met him back in 1956, when he told me how big the church would ultimately grow to be, and how great the work would be and what its impact would be. He told me that we would suffer persecution, meaning he would suffer persecution, but he used the word we. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, I said, if what you say is true, and if it comes to pass, I have no reason to believe that it will not, I want to remind you that you will then be in the vanguard of all those at that time fighting for the freedom of religion because you have had a free ride so far. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, certainly you know of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he said, yes. I said, well, in the 30s, they fought all the battles. Freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and most important, freedom of religion. The Jehovah's Witnesses could have very easily paid what was really paramount to a token fee, licensing fee, a fee that was being extracted from them for the privilege of disseminating their literature, as they still do today on street corners and what have you. And they argued, in essence, that would be ransom, paying a ransom for our First Amendment rights. And so I explained that to Mr. Armstrong, that one day, if he were correct, and if what he sees the Bible foretelling comes true, as our power and our impact upon people are enhanced, surely with the persecution will follow. And with that persecution will come persecution from the greatest enemy of the church, the greatest enemy in this world. It's always been government. Government clearly is the enemy. Just as the brethren have found out that we need protection now from the government, at the very time that the government is saying, we are only here to protect you, that has always been a fiction, that's always been a fraud upon the people, not only in the name of religion, but other kinds. God forbid that any of us need protection, real protection from the government. It's one thing to talk about protection of the type where we're dealing with things, matters of public safety, and we're dealing with the so-called police powers of the state. But really, our Constitution was designed so that the state's power, the power of the state was cut down. The federal government, for example, was only supposed to defend our shores from invasion, from without. And state governments were not supposed to rule the lives of the people at the local level. But you know what's happened over the years? There's been this creeping socialism and creeping bureaucracy. So now, some fella who gets himself a job, a career job with the Attorney General, would like to be able to supervise the work of the Worldwide Church of God. He would like to set the standards. He would like to determine what we should do, when we should do it, how much it should cost us, and who should do it. This, Mr. Armstrong, would never tolerate, none of us would. So we have had to assert our First Amendment rights for ourselves as well as for others. And as some of you may have realized recently, the National Council of Churches has come out very vigorously in our defense, really has attacked the government for interfering with our rights. And the Seventh-day Adventists through the Liberty Magazine have done the same. Gradually, more and more people are coming to the fore and are letting us know in one way or another that they're watching what is going on, they're very concerned about it, about what's happening, what has happened, and that when they can be of the most help, they will be there. Because we're still at a very low procedural level of activity, because we are resisting on constitutional ground, step by step. Not literally do we refuse to answer our name when we're asked, but for all practical purposes, we're not going to answer any question until the Supreme Court of the United States tells us in very plain language that we must. And once the Supreme Court of the United States tells us that we must, then in our opinion, and the opinion of many others now, there will be no more religious freedom in the United States. It will be a thing of the past. But once we've crossed that bridge, and the Supreme Court of the United States has said, you must do this, you must do that, you must refrain from this, you must refrain from that, then we will answer the questions. On the other hand, Mr. Armstrong and I have said from the beginning, we're very happy to defend ourselves, very happy to show that we have done no wrong. We've just completed a 5-month audit, which, if conducted under normal circumstances, would have probably taken a year to 2 years to accomplish. But we threw that much effort into it in a short period of time, maximizing the amount of people that could be utilized within the organization and without the organization to bring about the audit. We would have never permitted that if we didn't know something very well, that the records of the church and the college and the foundation would vindicate us fully. And that's very important. Just as all of our employees in the data processing building, the mail opening building, the accounting offices knew that all the allegations were false. So we knew they were false. And now we've prepared ourselves in the event that we must go to trial. But we were hoping that the appellate court somewhere will decide that everything that's happened is, as we have described it, void ab initio. You might ask yourselves, why did all of this happen? Well, I think it's very obvious to any informed or enlightened observer. There were three different parties or combinations of people who were involved in bringing this lawsuit, which itself makes it odd. If it had just been the state of California versus the Worldwide Church of God, it would have never taken this form. The state would have moved against the church, assuming it thought it had a proper cause to do so, just as it moved against the Faith Center people, Dr. Scott's Faith Center people. They moved administratively. He resisted, and he's still resisting, and will probably prevail. But they moved against him administratively. They served him with a subpoena and said, we have a right to look at everything that you've done in the last 10 years. We're at a certain address on Wilshire Boulevard. Now, on a certain day, you bring everything with you and give it to us, and we're going to ask you all kinds of questions. He said, fine, thank you very much, but no thank you. And he tore up the subpoena and he went to court. Now, why did that happen? Because it was a little different. In our case, we had a few former church members who had fallen into the camp of Mr. Armstrong's son, who was disfellowshipped and publicly marked by Mr. Armstrong last. And these people, falling on the influence of Ted Armstrong and others who were in sympathy with him, decided that they would bring a lawsuit, if they could, against the church, in an effort to drive Mr. Herbert Armstrong out of office and to permit a return to Garner Ted Armstrong, who had been called for the last 7 years unfit and unqualified even to be a minister, no less to be a person in any position of authority. His father publicly begged forgiveness of the entirety of the brethren for, unfortunately, doing what he promised he would never do, i.e. becoming a respecter of persons and failing to do what Eli failed to do to wit, to punish his sons for their own wrongdoing. At any rate, these six people got together with several lawyers who were only interested in one thing. They were interested in making money. Now, by itself, there's nothing wrong with making money. But if it had been two different lawyers, I think the result would have been different. Because after all, if someone came to me when I was practicing law and said they have a grievance against X or Y or Z, I was trained that if that be true, I try to correct the grievance without a lawsuit. My understanding is that there is an underlying state social policy which says avoid litigation, reconcile the parties if possible, and if you can do so outside the courtroom, by all means do so. We never even got a phone call, not to mention a letter or a demand. So they were in it for the money, and we have depositions which prove that beyond the shadow of a doubt. They were going to extract money from the church by way of the gimmick that they contrived. The gimmick was a receiver. Now, Mr. Armstrong is a very wise man, and it didn't take him very long, maybe that long, to put the right twist on the word receiver. And he has never referred to him any other way other than deceiver, because it was a money-making scam. It would be a rip-off. They planned to take $350,000 a month out of this work for as long as they could. Let me give you an example so you understand I'm not just talking in hyperbolic tones. They claimed that Big Sandy, our Texas campus, was worth $30 million. And yet, Judge Title found it was worth $6.6 million at the most. And we were selling it for $10.6 million. The very first thing the receiver tried to do once the judge confirmed his appointment was to get court approval for the sale of the Big Sandy property at $10.6 million. But he was so greedy, so very greedy, remember that's all he was in this for anyway, was the money, that he asked that the money be paid to his receiver's account. So, one way or another, we knew we couldn't permit that. So some of the church brethren had the foresight from the Milwaukee area to file an action in federal court in Texas, and they convinced a Texas judge down there that there'd be something wrong about that money going into the hands of Judge Wiseman. Judge Wiseman never got the money, and the property remains ours. We still have a contract for the sale of the property at $10.6 million, and we're hoping to close it. But can you imagine what that receiver would have done with that $10.6 million? The third day that he was here, he demanded that $50,000 be put into his account. $50,000 into his account. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So they were in it for the money. One of the lawyers was making all kinds of statements that he was a do-gooder, that he was in this thing for what was called pro bono publico, for the public good. But once we smashed it in its efforts to have a receiver and put them to rout, and it became obvious there would be no church money finding its way into the hands of any outside party, then he showed his true colors, and he said, well, I've already earned $100,000, and I want the court to approve the payment of the $100,000 for 6 weeks' work. The court said no. And he cried practically in court, begging in court like a seal begging for a fish. It was the most incredible performance. Nobody there, of our lawyers, and we had many, with many, many years of experience, ever seen a lawyer beg for his fees like this man begged the judge to give him $100,000 of church tithe. He didn't get it, he never will. We'll get the $50,000 back from the receiver. We'll get every penny back, and then we'll turn around and we'll sue him. And I'm just hoping that he has a very deep pocket for the damage that he's done to us. And so from the beginning, this has been a sham as far as the dissenters were concerned. They wanted to put Mr. Armstrong out, and they wanted to put somebody else in. Well, we know, those of us who are members, know that isn't the way it's done. That no one is going to put Mr. Armstrong out of office. And the only way you're sure not to get into office is to go about it the way they went about it. In addition, I think this is important, as I said before, the receiver's motive was money. And the receiver and those people who thought up the idea of a lawsuit, the lawyers and what have you, it was all money. Now, what was the state's interest? Without boring you on this whole question of First Amendment and government power, there has been in this state of California a concerted effort for some time now that Mr. Helge and I have been very mindful of. We have been attending the state legislature's committee meetings. They've been drafting legislation over a period of years. All of us who are engaged in the field have been concerned about the creeping effort of the state to take control of church property, at least from a supervisory standpoint. And we have been resisting it. Mormons have been resisting it. Other religious groups have been resisting it. But we've all been attending the meetings. I believe that the state liked the facts, which were non-facts, that were brought to it by the people representing these six dissenters. We were just in the aftermath or the fallout of the Guyana situation. So we had that militating against us. And there was a tendency on the Los Angeles office of the Charitable Corporations Division to be quite officious in their approach beyond and above what normal bureaucratic procedure would be. So it looked perfect, looked like we were small enough to be easily handled by this kind of action. We looked like we were divided, which we were not, but it looked like we were. We looked as though we would give no resistance because the people were going to literally greet these people from the receiver's office and the state as, liberators. And we were big enough to be able to pay out a ton of money in fees, which was important to the receiver, and also big enough in the sense that if the state were to actually be permitted to accomplish its will, to set a precedent. Now, I was asked a very good question a few months ago now by Michael Jackson, who was a local radio and television interviewer. And it was the perfect question, totally impromptu. He said, has this whole affair affected me in any way? Has it changed me? He'd known me for some time, and he didn't see any visible changes. I explained to him that, well, I was perfectly equipped to handle this type of thing because I had the training for it, and stress doesn't bother me, and having God on my side makes it all that much easier. But I said, I have changed in one very important respect. I said, for years, I argued with Mr. Armstrong. Literally argued with him, tooth and nail, because I thought many of his views about lawyers, judges, and government were immoderate. I always thought he was going a little bit beyond the pale. Now, maybe I said I was a little defensive because I was a lawyer by training and a law professor, and I considered myself as part of the system to that extent, and I wasn't a church member until just recently. And in the modern language, it was somewhat of a put-down. And in a nice way, nice as I could be under the circumstances, I would tell Mr. Armstrong, well, all the judges aren't bad, Mr. Armstrong, and all government isn't bad, and all lawyers aren't bad. And no, Stan, you're wrong. The Bible says unjust judges, the only reference directly to judges. Everybody knows about shyster lawyers. Everybody who should know would know that government is the big government's bad. Bigger government is worse, and the government is the enemy of the people, basically, and is also the enemy of church and religion. And I argued and I argued and I argued. Well, once again, I found out, as I found out on almost every important issue that I've ever disagreed with concerning Mr. Armstrong, that I was wrong, he was right. And I asked him since, I said, well, what made you so sure you were right, and what made me... You know, what made you so sure that I was wrong in this instance? And he smiled and he said, because the Bible, which is the foundation of all knowledge, told him so. And if our attorneys have learned nothing else from this as yet, if they haven't become the most astute lawyers in the constitutional field as yet, if they haven't become masters of the doctrines of the Worldwide Church of God and the operations and activities in the church, which of course are worldwide in nature and scope, they haven't learned any of that, or haven't learned it fully. They too have had their confidence in the system shaken, because they have seen enough to know that nothing about the state's position is true. They know that it is false. They know that it is a sham. They know that it's been an abuse of power, a naked, raw abuse of power. And yet, but for the living God, but for the immediate and massive support of the members of the church, but for Mr. Armstrong's inspired leadership, and but for the financial resources that are available to few organizations, the state would have accomplished its will. And therefore, their faith in the system has been shattered. Because how many organizations or people would be able to defend against such an onslaught as we were, with the living God behind us, 100,000 people doing whatever they could physically, spiritually, and financially? And how many people would have the gifted leadership, or how many organizations would have the gifted leadership of Mr. Herbert Armstrong, who literally smashed the state every time he wrote a letter.
Thank you for listening to this audio file from the Worldwide Church of God Library Collection. Please visit wwcg-library.com and explore the incredible truths that answer the mysteries of life.